The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I am excited to introduce our guests. Described as a genuine artist who can render the intricate dazzle of it all and at the same time plumb its philosophical implications, Richard Powers won the 2019 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction for The Overstory, his world-shifting tale of activism, the natural world, and people's connection to trees. His many other novels include Orfeo, The Echo Maker, The Time of Our Singing, and Three Farmers on Their Way to a Dance. Powers has earned the National Book Award, a MacArthur Fellowship, and two Pushcart Prizes. His new novel, Bewilderment, follows a widower astrobiologist dealing with both the mysteries of the cosmos and the troubles befalling his young son. Tonight, he'll be in conversation with Andrew Irvin, critic and author of Extraordinary Renditions, Burning Down George Orwell's House, and Bit by Bit, How Video Games Transformed Our World. He teaches in the MFA program at Temple University, Go Owls, and from the School of Interactive Games and Media at Rochester Institute of Technology. Rick, Andrew, it's great to have you back. The screen is yours.
Thank you, Andy. Of course, we're all eager to be back in your auditorium sometime soon. In the meantime, thank you everybody for being here. Rick, it's great to see you.
Great to see you too. It's been a couple of years. I think this is my third visit to this wonderful series, the first in such a peculiar format. It's marvelous to be back in Philly, if only virtually.
So you're not used to the new normal yet.
You know, I think I was the last person in North America to use Zoom, and it was 2 weeks ago. I've been living to my great delight and benefit in the Smoky Mountains in southern Appalachia for the last 5 years. I moved there as the result of researching the Overstory, where I went down to visit the old growth trees and just fell in love with this magnificent recovering wilderness and remaining bits of primary forest. The mountains make broadband impossible. And I am lucky to have a phone conversation if I can stand in the one little spot in my house marked with an X. And streaming is out of the realm of possibility. So unlike everyone else, I have spent the last year and a half with the perfect built-in excuse not to participate in teleconferencing. It's been quite a shock. I've come down out of the mountains and taken a hotel room in the big city of Knoxville, about an hour from my house, in order to use the hotel Wi-Fi and participate in these events. And it's I'm getting an education, a belated education in what lockdown has looked like for so many other people. Mm.
It's great that this has worked out. I appreciate you making the trip, and it's exciting to get to talk to you about Bewilderment. Congratulations! What an amazing novel.
Thanks.
In Andy's introduction, he talks about the awards you've won and the prizes, and the list goes on. Do you ever get tired of hearing that?
You know, I always, it makes me feel like I have to start working harder to earn some of them. You know, there's this odd, you know, belated sense of imposter syndrome. I guess we probably all have that to some extent. The funny thing about the writing career is you're only really engaged with what you're doing in the moment. You know, that when I think of those books that I wrote 36 years ago now, you know, this Bewilderment's my 13th book, and I, you know, my first book was published in the mid 1980s. When I think about those early books, I can't take possession of them. I can barely remember the guy who did them. And I'm delighted that he did them, because I wouldn't be able to. You know, there's a kind of, you know, goofiness and energy and youthful fervor in those books that delight me. But, you know, I just don't feel continuous with that person. But that's the strangeness, but also the beauty of writing. It's you're inventing a new way to be in relationship to the world, and every book changes that relationship. Mm-hmm. So as the books float downstream, whether they're still being read or whether they're completely forgotten, it's kind of immaterial, because you know your narrative is pointed in the other direction.
I see. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
One of the credits that I don't hear in your introductions is one that I'd like to speak to personally, which is, I don't know that people recognize what an amazing teacher you are and have been. I benefited from studying with you as a grad student. For those of you at home, if you think the fiction's amazing, because it is, Richard as a professor is even more profound and more powerful and more dedicated. And I've been very lucky to get that experience. So.
Well, bless you. You make me feel like I should never have given up the day job.
Well, if the result is bewilderment, I'm glad you did.
Thank you. Well, what I was trying to remember, Andrew was in the second class of MFAs at the University of Illinois. That is the year after we first began the program. So it's amazing to me and delightful that your MFA students are in the audience tonight. I feel like a grandfather somehow. what year did you start at Illinois?
I think 2005 to 2008. Yeah. It was a 3-year program.
And you were asking about taking pleasure in or ownership of literary awards and whether that ever gets tired. Oddly, your accomplishments and the accomplishments of the other students who came through that program, who I worked with, are in a way more enduringly gratifying to me, because, you know, I feel like, you know, what I put my hand to may or may not work, and the degree to which it satisfies other people is really immaterial with regard to, you know, what it is that I'm trying to get from that process. But when I look at you and my other students and see them publishing again and again and getting recognitions of all kinds, I feel like, well, actually that classroom interaction has a demonstrable connection to, you know, to that productivity, and that's a good feeling.
But certainly had a you've had a profound effect on me, and indirectly and directly in many regards through my own students. So I remain grateful to that.
Love it.
Have you had the chance to reflect on how your writing life has changed, or your writing habits have changed since moving from Illinois to Tennessee, to the mountains?
So yeah, I retired from Illinois at the age of 55. And I went west first, and I got seduced by Stanford, which is a very seductive place in a very seductive part of the world, and taught in their renowned and well-endowed writing program for a couple of years before leaving the classroom altogether. I think the writing has changed a lot since then, but not necessarily because I stopped teaching. Mm. It had more to do with what happened to me in Northern California, which was this beginning of my tree consciousness. So moving out Stanford and you know, living there, no slights to the landscape that we shared in Champaign-Urbana, but there is only so much communing with 1,000-mile-wide cornfields that a person can do. When you are in California, especially, you know, in the north, and you get exposed to those redwood forests, it changes the way that you think about plants and what plants are capable of doing and the lives of trees. And I think that's the journey that has changed my relationship to writing. It's sort of, it's turned me back to place. And when I moved from California to Tennessee, and, you know, for the last 5 years living in the Smokies, it's really the first time in my life where I have lived where I live and not in some, you know, social virtual place. That is where I've made it part of my life to figure out what other living things are around me, what they're trying to do, how they do it, you know, what each season brings, what each altitude brings. And you know, my relationship to the outside replaced writing as the primary point of focus in my life. Mm-hmm. You know, up to that point, it was the actual production of novels that centered my day and structured and grounded my personality and my behavior and, you know, my activities. I would, you know, I'd wake up in the morning and I would not release myself from work until I had 1,000 words that I was happy with. Mm-hmm. And that served me well, you know, produced many, many books, almost 12 books. But now in the Smokies, well, you know, I'm in my 60s and I've also, you know, I've published more than I ever expected to and written more than I ever expected to and had more recognition than I ever expected getting. So all of those release the centrality of having to produce that 1,000 words every day. But I think more importantly, being in that place and wanting to actually be an active member of this community that, you know, that the Southern Appalachia is so, you know, rich in producing, has meant that my day is now structured around what's happening outside. You know, what the season is, what the time of year, you know, what's in bloom. And when I get up now, I look out the window to see what my day is going to look like. And, you know, the writing may or may not follow, but being, you know, being an active member of my neighborhood and, you know, living in that place, is the source of my daily inspiration now, rather than the reward that I get for producing the inspiration out of my own imagination.
Oh, Rick, that's wonderful. What a lovely answer. We mentioned earlier that the last time we were at the Free Library together, we were celebrating the publication of The Overstory. And I'd be remiss if we didn't circle back around to what happened shortly after that conversation. The book went stratospheric. I don't know that it's returned to Earth yet. How did you get from that to bewilderment?
Yeah, and it's thank you. Yes. Always show the product. The completion of Overstory took a lot out of me. I mean, it was a 5.5 year process. The book ended up, you know, over 500 pages, and it treated 9 characters unfolding over decades and decades. Actually, if you count all of the backstories, it's centuries. Explored a variety of literary styles. It was almost an anthology of perspective and narrative approach. And I was exhausted at the end of it. And I really wasn't sure that I was going to continue to write. And yet there were things, there were questions at the Overstory raised that I was still engaged with, you know, even after that book was finished. And, you know, maybe because I toured longer for that book than for any previous book, those questions were still very present in my own mind. And when lockdown hit, and I went back to the Smokies and started living this solitary life in the woods, solitary only from the human perspective, not from the more than human perspective, those questions from Overstory were still resonating pretty strongly with me. And especially this question of, you know, what kind of shift in consciousness do we have to make? Who, you know, how do we have to change our sense of self and others in the world if we mean to stick around here much longer? You know, that question was still very salient in my head. And that's really the place that Bewilderment started. Bewilderment is a book that's really dominated by the Smokies. It starts in the Smokies and it ends in the Smokies, but it's also dominated by that question of what would it look like for someone to move from this human exceptionalist, individualist, commodity mediated culture of competition that we live in to this interdependent, reciprocal, integrated and accountable kind of consciousness that the Overstory began to explore, that kind of consciousness that I would put in opposition to modernism or capitalism and align with many, many indigenous cultures around the world over the course of human history. So, you know, Bewilderment is in a sense a kind of bud off of the tree of Overstory. You know, it's a kind of additional little speculation, a kind of fable of the working out of some of the larger principles in the Overstory in a dramatic confrontation, focusing on this father, this single father in his late 30s and his very intense and troubled 9-year-old boy.
This 9-year-old boy, Robin, or Robbie as he's called, it seems to be, he demonstrates an empathy for non-human life in a way that I found very engrossing. I see him as one of your greatest characters that you've created yet.
Thank you. That is very encouraging. You know, I here at 64, I feel like, you know, there are certain things that I'm finally learning how to make this you know, this medium do. So.
I've told a few friends behind the scenes, now the secret's out, that this is one of my absolute favorite novels of yours. And I'm going to ask this question as if you and I didn't talk about this ahead of time. Would you mind reading a small section for us?
No, I'd be delighted.
Thank you.
I propose a section that's very near the beginning of the book that helps to establish Theo and Robin, and actually put in motion a couple of the dramatic conflicts that propel the story forward and ultimately have the ramifications that are revealed in the book's climax. This book is told entirely in the first person by Theo, by Robin's father. And in this short passage, probably will take about 4 minutes to read. Theo is introducing his ambivalence and uncertainty as to how to understand his son's behavioral problems and non-normal temperament. I never believed the diagnoses the doctors settled on my son. When a condition gets three different names over as many decades, when it requires two subcategories to account for completely contradictory symptoms, When it goes from non-existent to the country's most commonly diagnosed childhood disorder in the course of one generation, when two different physicians want to prescribe three different medications, there's something wrong. My Robin didn't always sleep well. He wet the bed a few times a season, and it hunched him over with shame. Noises unsettled him. He liked to turn the sound way down on the television, too low for me to hear. He hated when the cloth monkey wasn't on its perch in the laundry room above the washing machine. He poured every dollar of allowance into a trading card game, collect them all, but he kept the untouched cards in numeric order in plastic sleeves in a special binder. He could smell a fart from across a crowded movie theater. He'd focus for hours on Minerals of Nevada or the Kings and Queens of England, anything in tables. He sketched constantly and well, laboring over fine details lost on me. Intricate buildings and machines for a year, then animals and plants. His pronouncements were off-the-wall mysteries to everyone except me. He could quote whole scenes from movies, even after a single viewing. He rehearsed memories endlessly, and every repetition of the details made him happier. When he finished a book, he liked, he'd start it again immediately from page one. He melted down and exploded over nothing, but he could just as easily be overcome by joy. On rough nights when Robin retreated to my bed, he wanted to be on the side farthest from the endless terrors outside the window. His mother had always wanted the safe side too. He daydreamed, had trouble with deadlines, and yes, he refused to focus on things that didn't interest him. But he never fidgeted or dashed around or talked without stopping, and he could hold still for hours with things he loved. Tell me what deficit matched up with all that. What disorder explained him? The suggestions were plentiful, including syndromes linked to the billion pounds of toxins sprayed on the country's food supply each year. His second pediatrician was keen to put Robin on the spectrum. I wanted to tell the man that everyone alive on this fluke little planet was on the spectrum. That's what a spectrum is. I wanted to tell the man that life itself is a spectrum disorder, where each of us vibrated at some unique frequency in the continuous rainbow. Then I wanted to punch him. I suppose there's a name for that too. Oddly enough, there's no name in the DSM for the compulsion to diagnose people. When his school suspended Robin for 2 days and put their own doctors on the case, I felt like the last reactionary throwback. What was there to explain? Synthetic clothing gave him hideous eczema. His classmates harassed him for not understanding their vicious gossip. His mother was crushed to death when he was 7. His beloved dog died of confusion a few months later. What more reason for disturbed behavior did any doctor need? Watching medicine fail my child, I developed a crackpot theory. Life is something we need to stop correcting. My boy was a pocket universe I could never hope to fathom. Every one of us is an experiment, and we don't even know what the experiment is testing. My wife would have known how to talk to the doctors. Nobody's perfect, she liked to say. But man, we all fall short so beautifully.
Oh, Rick, that's astounding. Absolutely beautiful writing. Thank you for doing that.
Thanks.
Wow.
Well, there you have these two lost boys in a nutshell. And you know, it's interesting. I was thinking about this, in conjunction to back in the day when you know, we were teaching point of view in person. Mm-hmm. And as I was reading this passage, I was thinking, you know, here's a classic first person narration, because this Theo is saying, let me tell you about my son, Robin. Mm-hmm. But what we're getting are all the confusions and fears and uncertainties and, you know, pushbacks in Theo, things that we as the readers may begin to understand about him more than he understands about himself. And, you know, that to me, that choice of first person is always a choice for indirection. It's always a way of saying, I'm going to put myself on display in order to ask you to understand the world around me in a certain way. But in reality, I'm pointing the camera back on myself without even knowing it.
Right. Perfect. Yeah. And not to get too inside baseball here, but that use of first person for him, for the father, creates a sense of Robin's inability to think about himself. It casts that in sort of a brighter light, which is really wonderful. So the right. contrast that Robin is never concerned about himself. He's concerned about that squirrel in the road. He's concerned about the cows in Texas. There's always something other than himself.
That's right.
So that's a beautiful dynamic between the two of them.
Yeah. And at this point in the novel, the passage came from pages 4 and 5 of the book. The book is 250 pages long. At this point in the novel, the reader might be thinking, come on, man, you can't turn your back on medical science. Mm-hmm. Or the reader might be saying, yes, I think this guy knows his son better than the doctors. But the judgment is the jury is out, mm-hmm. On whether Theo's judgment on Robin is correct or not. And that's what creates that sort of secondary drama when someone who's in the story is also telling you the story.
Right.
Because they're a guilty party too.
Yeah, beautiful. And for those of you in the audience tonight who've not read it yet, the way this plays out is staggering, and the less I say about that, the better, but you have that to look forward to if you've not gotten there yet. Most of your novels have some a foot in current events or political, they're not political novels specifically, but broadly speaking, I suppose, or at least most of them. There's occasionally social commentary and things like that, which I guess is necessary for a novelist, particularly now. Mm-hmm. I don't recall a book of yours wading so directly into contemporary American electoral politics.
Well, it's true. But there's also a little paradox here as well. This is the first book where I've explicitly taken the certain recognizable particulars of present-day geopolitics, mm-hmm. and made them essential elements of the story, of the plot. And the way that these geopolitics impinge on the personal story is very much a part of the forward motion of the book. And the things that end up happening to Theo and Robin happen in part because of their local choices and their local struggling with their own temperament and their own interactions. But they also happen because this greater world around them is pressing down on them and impinging upon them and securing their fates in a way. But the paradox is this book is also the first time that I've ever created something like the science fiction device of the alternate world, you know, either like the near future where it's sort of like where we are, but some rules are changed, you know, that allow the exploration of some new trajectory. In this case, more like a near present. The world that's being depicted will seem familiar to readers, but it will also seem strange. And there will be non-alignments. There will be things that happen in the book that haven't happened to us in the last 3 or 4 years. And there will be, you know, I use this to create a kind of estrangement effect in the reader's mind. Where are we exactly? And what can I take for granted? And that uncertainty and the potential to remain surprised by the way that the geopolitics unfolds, I think, is also part of the story. I use a kind of parallel Earth to make the Earth that we have just lived through strange again for us, as if it weren't strange enough when we lived through it the first time. But this sort of triangulation from the related but different to be a kind of way to look back on the place that we've just been through and think about it again from different perspectives.
That's great. And again, that estrangement sort of again speaks so well to Robin, because he is estranged. He's estranged from everything except for himself and the natural world. So that's one of those beautiful tendrils that runs through here. We have a couple people typing in with questions, and I'll get to those in just a second. There's one thing I've been meaning to ask you for a while, and this is a very serious book, as was The Overstory. And for all of the critical reception of your novels over the years, all of the accolades and things like that, I've never heard anybody talk about the humor in your books. The humor is typically more cosmic than slapstick, but there's always something funny, even in a very, very serious book like this one. And that's a part of your personality, I guess, because I've seen that in the flesh, that might be more apparent on the page to me than others. I'm not sure. What do you find funny?
Well, classic definitions of humor involve some kind of a collision between two things that don't seem to have a relation, that in some momentary comic moment reveal some absurd affinity. There are rhetorical tropes of humor that are irresistible to me. You mentioned the seriousness of the books, and that's, they all do grapple with, large and earnest questions. But even that grappling has to be treated with a kind of expansive acceptance, and the characters who are doing the grappling are themselves such frail and limited creatures, and the constant desire to know where a person is, it's not comical per se, it's not funny, but it has to reveal the underside of seriousness, which is a kind of a tender acceptance of the absurdity of our existence and the limits of our ability to know ourselves. Some of the humor on the page is character driven. It's people being smartasses or wisecracking. But I also like to create a sort of narrational burlesque where something is given at face value and the reader has to somehow stumble on that and say, aren't we a peculiar species? Don't we do the strangest things and want the strangest things? And that moment of self-acceptance and humbling, the comic deflation of the grand desire to know it, where we are and where we're headed, I think is very important to me.
That comes clear to me, I'm sure. And again, that there are moments in your books where I do find myself laughing, and I'd like to see that addressed more by the critics at large. One more question for you, and then I'll start going through the list that I have here popping up on my screen way too fast. I don't want to ask you if you've started something new, if you're working on something new, because you know that even talking about that can be disruptive, I think, for a lot of writers. And I wouldn't put you in that position. But out of curiosity, are there topics that you've been eager to take a deep dive into that you're planning soon?
There are. I find myself wanting to revisit something that I wrote about almost 30 years ago. Now that we're entering into an age where the things that I explored about artificial intelligence in Galatea 2.2 are actually almost commonplace. I don't know, I'm ambivalent about it, but there are ways in which algorithms are taking over our lives and creating new habits that are not entirely ours alone and that we're not always conscious about that really fascinate me. And I have brewing a story about life in the age of the algorithm.
Oh, wonderful. Looking forward to it. Thank you. Jeff Klebauskas, who was recently one of my MFA students, has a question for you. One of those students that comes along and you end up learning more from him than he does from you.
I'm talking to one right now, actually.
Is writing a form of activism for you? Do you think it should be for all fiction writers?
If by activism you mean a commitment to engage the world, the justices and injustices in your thinking and in your action, I'm not sure how writing could be devoid of that. I mean, we in you know, belletristic literary fiction, we have for a long time nurtured this idea that our own moral certainties as an author have to be kept off the stage, and instead the possibilities and ambiguities of moral collision on stage have to be allowed to reach their full potential and to show the complete spectrum of rightness and wrongness in almost any position. I'm not interested in writing that kind of fiction. I'm interested in writing the kind of fiction where the characters are themselves stumbling forward in their commitment to engage the world on moral grounds. Is the point of that fiction to make readers more activists? To foster a commitment to practical political activism on the part of the reader? No, not necessarily. But the journey itself, the story, is about, it always circles around people who are struggling to find that purpose for themselves, to attach themselves to larger systems of meaning. I guess that may be the principal difference that I see emerging between me and the kinds of literature that I was brought up on. It's not so much that my fiction is a fiction of, but that the journey of my characters is not toward ambiguity, but rather it's a journey toward engagement and commitment and moral orientation.
I'm gonna have to watch this video again. That's a great answer. Wonderful. Thank you. Jeff, thank you for that question. Peggy and Mark Kerchak are referring to the time of our singing and your immersion in classical music and the implications of racial justice. What are the places of these issues in your life right now?
I have to say that I was absolutely thrilled when the opera based on that novel, which has been in the works for over 10 years, premiered in Brussels last week and has been receiving wonderful press in many countries in Europe. And it moves me to think of this American book about a very American story about the question of race and cultural ownership as it plays out so tumultuously over the course of several decades in the 20th century America, would somehow be appealing enough for a multinational cast in Europe, including Americans in both the orchestra and in the cast, that this story would be compelling enough to, you know, to Europeans to want to stage an opera over there. And it's very interesting to see that opera premiere again become so timely and so charged here in this country. And the book was published in 2003, and it tells of a mixed race family, generations in a mixed race family, struggling to justify their cultural choices, struggling also to survive a country that is so traumatized by race, as you know, as Du Bois said, the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line, and to see that book come up again in Trump America, in post-Trump America, with this resurgence of all of white nationalism, of white paternalism, and to see our country once again, you know, revisiting almost, you know, the return of the repressed, almost like another chapter of the book that I wrote and published in 2003.
Yeah, it's exciting that that's gotten so far. Congratulations.
Yeah, it's so wonderful to see.
That's fun. One of your high school classmates at ISB has tuned in, Jane Wilson.
No kidding. No kidding.
So she sends her congratulations.
Hello, Jane.
How proud she is and all of that. She wants to know how living in Thailand as a teenager have formed your desire to write or has affected some of your subject matter.
It's amazing in my memory to Bangkok when I was writing Bewilderment and, you know, trying to channel this boy who ends up at the end of the book, the age that I was when I moved to Thailand, in the act of plumbing my own memories of that age to create this boy, I almost unconsciously brought into the book a whole superimposed layer of Buddhists. And, you know, when I finished the novel and went back to proofread it, I was amazed at how many Buddhist philosophical references, cultural references there are in the book. And I suddenly realized why that was. I was simply going back to my years in Bangkok and, you know, in a Buddhist country and reliving my own childhood in the light of that culture. And it was, you know, this sort of unconscious influence on Bewilderment was quite a delight to discover belatedly. But that same principle of interbeing that's so essential in Robin's journey through the decoded neurofeedback training in the heart of the book is is a little literal recreation of the things that I was learning when I was visiting my older brother after he was ordained as a Buddhist monk while I was in high school in Thailand. So that's a fairly specific example of the way that Thailand influenced writing. Other books have been even more overtly influenced. Operation Wandering Soul has a character who has experiences in Southeast Asia from around the time period that I do. And that novel is very strongly inflected by a lot of my memories from my life in Thailand.
I don't think I ever knew that you lived there. That's cool. We've got a question from Thomas Terry, who also about Robin. Did you spend time watching Friends' Children in order to create the dynamic, the quotidian aspects of their relationship? It seemed very natural, and thanks for your books.
You know, there were three very specific children who I was channeling as I created Robin. And they actually were children who I had a kind of vicarious surrogate parenting relationship with at different times in my life. Mm. And, you know, I did go through the attic and pull out all the pictures and hand scribble letters and all everything that I could find. One of these children was a nephew. One was a niece. And one was the child of a colleague of mine from the University of Illinois, who I worked with for many years. And you know, it was just, it was an exercise in stillness and retrieval to try to remember how these kids worked, the way that they talked, the way they used their bodies. But there were, you know, there were these three very specific models that I was recalling.
That's great that you had that. It did seem very naturalistic to me. My own similar experiences with nephews, and that was one of the things that I think I loved the most about this book. Mm. So, what is your day like in Appalachia? And this is from Brian Rudnick.
What is my day like?
Yes.
Yeah, and that's been the beautiful thing about living in Southern Appalachia, as I was describing earlier. My day will have a very different quality depending on whether it's June or November, or whether it's raining or clear, or whether it's 90 degrees and 90% humidity, or 60 degrees and clear skies. The landscape shapes the day. And, you know, that's been a joy to, people, I think have explored our sleeping patterns. And this, you know, this idea that you're supposed to get 8 hours of sleep every night, and have found actually that when people are attuned to the place that they live, their sleep will get longer or shorter depending on the length of the day, as other mammals do. And that's been the case with me over the last several years. The entire shape of my day changes as we go from season to season. With regard to writing, you know, I have to be honest, although I don't have a daily regimen anymore where I say, you know, I need to hit this mark before I'm off the hook. When I am walking, or when I am, you know, sitting in a river, in a cold river, or you know, out on a trail, botanizing or watching animals, the words come a lot faster than when I'm in my room trying to channel them at my desk, and I usually can't walk more than 2 or 3 miles down a trail before I have to stop and pull out the notebook and scribble things down. Or, you know, if I've forgotten to bring the notebook, turn around on the trail and rush back home while the ideas are still intact.
Very cool. You have written books in the past by speaking them aloud. Do you still do that?
I don't, not very much. I use it sparingly now, more for note taking and scene brainstorming. Mm-hmm. I will sometimes now use handwriting recognition when I really want to slow down the construction of a scene, mm-hmm. and when I want to have that kind of tactile sense of, you know, word by word accumulation. And to feel it in a pen the way I did when I was first starting out before word processors. But, you know, as with other media, you use the one that's appropriate in the moment for the job that you're trying to do. And I will use all three, speech, handwriting, and typing, depending on where I am in the compositional process and what kind of scene I'm building at the time.
Great. So there's some method acting going on, perhaps.
Yeah.
Following that up, Bernard Russo has a question about the kind of research you did for The Overstory and how much of that involved visiting specific places. And if Bernard will forgive me, I'll extend that question to Bewilderment as well.
Oh, good. Yeah, there was a lot of book research for Overstory. And I did end up reading over 120 book-length studies of trees. That's just, you know, bound individual volumes, not counting articles or online material. So, and I still am researching for The Overstory. I have in my upstairs bedroom in the Smokies an entire bookshelf devoted to trees, and I still get tremendously excited when I find a new one. But the real research, obviously, was being with trees in situ and moving around the country and seeing the ways that place change so dramatically, what trees do and how they do it. And forgive me if I think I may have hinted this earlier, but I actually moved to the Smokies because of research on The Overstory. I kept reading about the old growth forests in the East and how few there were remaining. Only 2% of the forest cover of the eastern United States is still considered primary forest. The rest, you know, was cut down and is, you know, simply recovering. And, you know, I kept reading that if you want to see what the old growth looked like, that the place to go was the Smokies, because it was the largest contiguous remaining primary forest chunks in the eastern U.S. And I went there just on a 3-day research trip, and my first hikes just up into the old growth to see what it looked like, and I was knocked out by it. I mean, the sight of it, the sound of it, the smell of it, how obviously species rich it was compared to a recovering forest. And I had this wild moment where I realized that, you know, even though I'm an Eastern U.S. American, that I had never seen, I had to get to the age of 58 before I saw what a healthy, fully functioning Eastern broadleaf American forest looked like. And it was it was an overwhelming feeling. And I was still thinking about that those forests 8 months later. And I figured, well, you know, that's got to say something. And I went back and bought a house, and I've been living there ever since. So the research for Overstory literally moved me into a new place in the country, and it completely changed the way that I think about my days and the way that I live my days. So you never know where a little bit of investigation is going to lead you. For Bewilderment, the research was directed mostly toward Theo Burns' field, which is astrobiology. It's a very young, burgeoning field. It wasn't even really a thing when I was Theo's age. It's come on in recent decades, and it's become subdivided itself. You know, it's growing in conjunction with the rapid discovery and detection and discovery of exoplanets. And so I did a fair amount of reading about both of those rapidly developing fields. They're tightly connected. But I think for the difference between the two books is in Overstory, what I learned about trees became very much foreground of me, is actually much underneath the narrative of these, the father and the son. It doesn't become a kind of primary subject in the same way as it does in the Overstory.
That's a very, very fair way to look at it. I can see that. I think we're starting to have some connectivity issues. I also feel like I've held your feet to the fire just about long enough. Let me finish up with two more questions that have come in, if I may.
Sure.
There's a follow-up question about the time of our singing question about classical music. Do you listen to classical music every day? And to which I'll add, do you still play cello?
You know, cello is a difficult instrument to make music by yourself. If you're alone in the mountains, there are the Bach suite and a couple of other noteworthy pieces for solo cello. But beyond that, you need your friends around to get the full enjoyment out of that instrument. So what I've been doing is teaching myself how to play piano, which is self-contained, you know, because it makes its own harmonies. There's both a vertical and a horizontal component to piano music. And I do play piano almost every day. And it can be maddening how hard it is to learn something at the age of 64 and how challenging it is to make your fingers learn new tricks at this age. But it's a daily joy to me. And however bad it is, there's no audience involved at all, but I can feel it rewiring my brain. You know, it's every bit as much an empathy machine as the decoded neurofeedback in Bewilderment.
Wonderful. I'm glad to hear that you're still doing that. Because I live with live music in the house, and there's nothing quite like it.
Yeah.
There's one more question that I can get to, and the question has been wonderful. So thank you, everybody. This is from LK. What do you imagine or hope is the power of your work to change minds, hearts, and hands toward protecting the environment?
My hope is a simple one. It's that my books might be an encouragement for people to realize how deeply woven their own lives are with the more than human world. I simply want to tell stories where we are part of an ensemble cast, and where we acknowledge all of the other deeply interconnected forms of life that are required to support us and to enable our existences. And if a person gets that, you know, if a person reads my novels, particularly my last two novels, and starts to see agency and intelligence and sacredness outside of the human, you know, beyond the human, that's enough for me. Because once that feeling is there, and once a sense of meaning and purpose start to get fostered by this idea of belonging to a community of living things that's larger than just our own species, those readers will find joy and find activity and find meaningful stories in their own way, you know, and whether they're direct activists or, you know, whether the change is simply an internal one, I can't control, and I don't really care. But it's that simple shift, believing that we're the only interesting game in town, that we're separate from all other living things, and that we can go it alone. Shifting from that kind of storytelling to the kind of storytelling that comes back to earth and wants to make a go of it with. That's all I'm trying to do with these books.
I can't dream up a better way to end this this conversation, Rick. Thank you so much for making the time to do this tonight. Thank you to all of our audience and our participants, to Andy and Jason and everybody at the Free Library. And Rick, most of all, thank you for writing such a truly extraordinary and wonderful book. I'm jealous of those who still get to look forward to this. Anything else on your mind before we say goodnight?
Thanks, Drew. It was a great pleasure. And thanks, Andy, for having us both. Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody. Much love, Rick. Thanks.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.